It's that time again. Time for another Torse Cabinet U.S. Politics Alternate History. The last time I did this, it was about a world where the 22nd Amendment never got signed and there are no term limits on the presidency. That video is fine, I guess. Go ahead and watch it and enjoy. I maintain it's realistic in terms of the sequence of presidents I came up with, but I don't think I really sufficiently thought through the implications of all that. Like, I had almost all the same global geopolitical events going on. It's very nothing ever happens. This episode's timeline is the opposite. It's got a somewhat similar premise, but creates an almost unrecognizable world by present day, both in the US and abroad. This video scenario is not that realistic. Starting with the point of divergence in our real-life 1970s, I don't think this could ever have really happened, but it's realistic in the sense that it's an internally consistent world with a billion different things going on at once. The idea I had was, what if every president of the US was their opposite party equivalent? The way this works is, for the last 50 years of US history, starting in 1976, every presidential election won by a Democrat in our timeline was won by a Republican in this one, and vice versa. And that doesn't just mean the opposite party candidate won the election. Like, I don't have Mondale defeating Reagan in 1984. I mean, every president in this timeline is a real-life politician, or public figure at least, who was the mirror image of the equivalent president in our timeline. Moderates remain moderates, a hard right candidate is switched out with a hard left candidate with similar biographical details or vibes. So for example, for the 90s, a young, charismatic, moderate Democrat from a minor rural state whose wife is also a politician is switched out with a moderate Republican with the same bio, Maine Governor John McKernan. I'm not doing that with anything but the presidency because I don't have time to come up with a whole alternate Senate and alternate governors and everything, but down ballot seats change too in response. So first I came up with a sequence of presidents from 1976 to today. I'd figured out who the equivalents of each president were, and then I had to weave together a coherent history of the last 50 years, explaining how each of these people got to be president. For my Democratic equivalent of Trump, I initially had Hank Green, which didn't make much sense at all, and I can't explain my thought process behind. Then I thought back to my Georgia Guidestones video, and I was like, of course, Ted Turner. If anyone's an equivalent of Trump except with weird lefty politics, it's Ted Turner. He was the founder of CNN, he is a foul-mouthed, megalomaniacal, womanizing media billionaire, and despite that, his politics are almost Unabomber-esque. He is a degrowth environmentalist who openly wants to reduce humanity's population. Then I began drawing up how this timeline was supposed to work, what the hot button issues would be that led to each of these people being president, and I realized that by the 2010s it wouldn't make sense to have someone with Ted Turner's politics become president in this world, and thinking about Trump's rise in decades-long big picture terms and considering what the equivalent big picture forces would have to be in this world, I landed on someone entirely different. You'll just have to watch the video and see. I have a politically diverse audience, which is one of my favorite things about Torse Cabinet, and I have to warn you, no matter your politics, at some point in this video, your political allies will do something that makes you go, "We'd never do that." This is a world with different politics, and you might not be happy with how your people are portrayed. One more thing, there is now a colored border around the screen. If the border is blue, I'm talking about something that really happened in real life exactly as I'm describing it. If the border is green, I'm talking about something that's based on real events, but the political valence of it is reversed. For example, Obama gave a stirring speech about race relations. Obama's Republican equivalent gives a stirring speech about race relations. Reagan signed an amnesty bill for illegal immigrants. Reagan's Democratic equivalent mobilizes the military to kick them out. If the border is red, this is something I'm completely making up on my own in order to get the timeline to fit the sequence of presidents that I got. All right. The needle's going all the way to the other end of the gauge. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Sluds the Shoggoth, and Thimble the Doll. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Can you leave your world?
So, here we go. The point of divergence on the national stage is 1976. Ford narrowly defeats Carter. All presidential election results in this world from then on are flipped. Whatever Republicans got in the popular vote, that goes to Democrats and vice versa. Why though? Why did Ford win in 76? Because the Republicans were more united around Ford, since the GOP primaries were largely uncontested and Ford didn't have to fight a bruising primary against Ronald Reagan, the way he did in our timeline. Why is Reagan out of the picture? Because of the real original divergence, the 1970 California gubernatorial election, in which Reagan was defeated in his bid for re-election by Democrat Burt Lancaster. Lancaster is an unabashed progressive, pro-civil rights, pro-social safety net, and one of the first fiercely anti-Vietnam War politicians elected to a major office. But he also has an incongruous streak of fiscal conservatism. One of the main issues he emphasized, and according to exit polls, by far the main reason he defeated Reagan, was his promise to reverse the tax increases Reagan passed during his first term. Lancaster doesn't see any kind of contradiction there with the rest of his ideology. He believes that if America were to get out of Vietnam and learn to peacefully coexist with the USSR, we could lower taxes and improve the social safety net at once. He may very well be right, but as governor of California, he doesn't have much power over national issues like that. Lancaster has one other interest that will cast a long shadow across history. Slapping tariffs on Japan, Germany, Korea, and other countries blue-collar American jobs are being shipped to. Economists sneer, but as one of the first American politicians to make outsourcing of industrial jobs central to his campaign, people love it. Lancaster's motto for his landslide re-election as governor in 1974 is "Bring them home," referring both to American troops in Vietnam and American industrial jobs. Because Lancaster proved what conventional American political wisdom already understood, Reagan was too far right for national politics, Reagan's political career is over, and he goes back to acting, reaching a surprising late career revival in the 70s and 80s, culminating in winning an Oscar for Best Actor for his role in 1981's On Golden Pond. His 4 years as governor of California are a footnote in the story of his life in Hollywood, a bit like how Arnold Schwarzenegger's own 7 years as governor are generally thought of today as secondary to his decades as an action hero. If the Supreme Court had ever handed down a decision granting a more lenient interpretation of the Natural Born Citizen Clause, I think Arnold would not just have been the Republican presidential nominee in 2012, he could well have defeated Obama, but that's another alt-his video. Lancaster is a serious candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1976, but loses by a hair to his main challenger, Jimmy Carter. Ford and his running mate Bob Dole narrowly defeat Carter. Then, everything that happened in the late 70s happens. Inflation gets worse, global crises keep popping up, and Ford, who was rapidly thrust into the presidency over a matter of months in 1974, is out of his depth. In Iran, protests against the Shah break out, which Ford's Secretary of State Henry Kissinger demands the Shah respond to with lethal force. Ford isn't a strong ally of Kissinger, but keeps him on in his cabinet mainly because he's intimidated by the guy. Thousands of Iranian protesters are massacred, and the rebellion is suppressed, but the whole world is watching. Americans fear that Kissinger is leading the country into another Vietnam, just a few years after they got done with the original one. A wave of protests against the administration's actions in Iran sweep America over the summer of 1978, and while they never get as widespread or as unruly as Vietnam War protests got, it's clear Americans aren't having it. Ford's approval rating tumbles. At Kissinger's suggestion, the ailing Shah, who everyone in his inner circle knows only has a few years left to live anyway, steps down and is replaced by his wife Farah, who oversees massive purges of would-be revolutionaries, but also an expansion of the social safety net to placate the Iranian people. Back in the US, Democrats win supermajorities in Congress in the 1978 midterms, and Burt Lancaster, as soon as he's term limited out of the California governorship in January 79, travels to the village in France where Ayatollah Khomeini is living in exile and conducts a sympathetic interview with the Ayatollah. Just a few days later, Khomeini is found dead in his house of a purported gas leak. Various countries point various fingers. The prevailing theory, gradually confirmed over decades as files become declassified, is that his death was the work of Mossad. Speaking of Mossad, at about the same time they launch a coup in Israel, replacing the democratically elected Prime Minister Shimon Peres with the writer Moshe Shamir. Democratically elected is doing some heavy lifting there, because Peres's party, the Alignment, the longtime natural governing party of Israel and the carrier of the torch of social democratic labor Zionism, narrowly defeated the right-wing Likud in the 1977 election amid substantial CIA involvement. Kissinger has been spending pretty much the entire Ford presidency trying to broker a deal between Egypt and Israel, and you might be surprised to learn that Kissinger was not a strong Zionist. In fact, he was pretty anti-Semitic, even though he was Jewish himself, born in Germany and came to America as a teenager to escape Hitler. Much later in life, he said, quote, "If it were not for the accident of my birth, I would be anti-Semitic, and any people who have been persecuted for 2,000 years must be doing something wrong." These are real quotes. It just could not be more cartoonishly evil. Anyway, after Ford wins the 1976 election, Kissinger continues his shuttle diplomacy in between Egypt and Israel to attempt to resolve their conflict, and he mostly sympathizes with Egypt. By the time Israel's 1977 election is imminent, it seems that Kissinger has worked out a peace treaty that has the backing of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, the UN, most of the world's major powers, and the alignment. In the 1977 Israeli election, Peres campaigns on accepting the treaty, but Israelis aren't having it. Likud, with its firebrand leader Menachem Begin demanding no surrender, opens up a huge lead in the polls. When Peres wins, amid not exactly subtle signs of ballot box stuffing and voter intimidation, riots break out in Orthodox neighborhoods. The next year, Peres is overthrown and exiled to the U.S. Moshe Shamir, a writer who is both a leftist and an ultranationalist, is put in charge by Mossad, cutting off ties to the U.S. and announcing Israel's new alliance with the USSR. The basic law is changed to read that Israel is a, quote, socialist, Jewish, and democratic state. It's not really any of those things in practice, as Shamir violently purges thousands of pro-peace leftists, as well as cracking down on the ultra-Orthodox, allowing public services to operate on the Sabbath for the first time. 1,300 Christian pilgrims from the U.S. are left stranded in Jerusalem and are forbidden from leaving, used as a bargaining chip by Shamir's hardline government, held in tunnels under Temple Mount. Leonid Brezhnev travels to Israel in 1979, proclaiming their new alliance with the USSR as proof that Soviets are the true friends of the oppressed and America must be rife with anti-Semitism. As the hostage crisis deepens, random anti-Semitic attacks do, in fact, become much more common in the U.S. The CIA scrambles together a team of Italian-American agents to pose as an Italian film crew, doing location scouting in the Holy Land for an epic about the Crusades to smuggle the hostages out. It fails. Some of the agents escape, others are caught and executed. Negotiations go on through the 1980 election, finally reaching a deal to send them home, but only a week before the end of Ford's presidency. Ford himself can't run again in 1980 since he originally became president just 3 months before the 1974 midterm elections. Therefore, his partial first term in office, before being elected to a full term in 76, counts as a full term, and by 1980 he's term limited. Incumbent Vice President Bob Dole takes his place as the Republican nominee, choosing National Security Advisor George H.W. Bush as his running mate, but amid Ford's unpopularity, the chaos abroad, and economic collapse at home, he's not able to differentiate himself from the incumbent administration. Democratic voters regret nominating Carter over Lancaster in 76, so Lancaster is a shoo-in for the Democratic nomination. As an actor and California governor, he's seen as good on domestic issues, but rather green on foreign policy, as well as a bit of an outsider to the Democratic mainstream, so he needs to pick a running mate who assuages those fears. Ted Kennedy openly campaigns for the vice presidency, but Lancaster picks a less scandal-plagued member of the Kennedy clan, Sergeant Shriver, whose first name is Sergeant. This is Shriver's second run for vice president in 8 years. Back in 1972, when George McGovern lost to Nixon in a landslide, one of the reasons McGovern lost so bad was because he initially picked Senator Thomas Eagleton as his running mate, then dumped him from the ticket when Eagleton was revealed to have undisclosed mental health issues. The person McGovern replaced Eagleton with was Shriver. So, who's Sergeant Shriver? He's a member of the Kennedys by marriage. His wife is Eunice Kennedy, a sister of John and Bobby and Ted, the ones you know. He never served in an elected office in our timeline. The only time he was on the ballot was his landslide loss on the Democratic ticket in 72. In JFK's administration, he founded the Peace Corps and Upward Bound. In LBJ's administration, he led the Office of Economic Opportunity, and under Nixon, he was ambassador to France. He co-founded the Special Olympics, then he was parachuted in at the last second to be the Democratic vice presidential nominee on McGovern's ill-fated ticket, and didn't really do much after that in our timeline. In this timeline here, Shriver gets named to the position of DNC chair in December 1972, largely because of then-Governor Lancaster's lobbying, the beginning of a shaky on-and-off political relationship between them. Shriver serves until 1977, becoming a visible and powerful figure in the Democrats, something the party committee chair never really was before him. Everyone who was DNC chair before him was a total nobody. Shriver really acts like he's the leader of the party and gets treated as such. When Carter narrowly loses to Ford, that obviously discredits Shriver a bit, and he steps down his chair as soon as Ford is sworn in for his 1.5th term. But Shriver still has enough goodwill with the Democratic mainstream that he's one of the main candidates challenging Lancaster for the nomination in the 1980 primaries. On the campaign trail, Shriver is for free trade, or at least freer trade, and attacks Lancaster's support for tariffs as voodoo economics. Lancaster's populist bluster carries the day, though. He and Shriver mend fences, and as expected, Lancaster names Shriver to his ticket to get his foreign policy expertise and clout with the Northeastern elite. In this timeline, people don't refer to the Kennedy family. They refer to America's premier political dynasty as the Kennedy-Shriver family, as it's the only family to produce 3 presidents, but 2 of them don't carry the name Kennedy. Bit of a spoiler, but if you've grasped the point of this alt-hist, you already know. Shriver is filling in the role of George Bush Sr., so obviously he and his son are both going to be president down the line. Democrats who are concerned that Lancaster is too left-wing, and Republicans who can't vote for Dole given the state of the country but would never support Lancaster, cobble together a centrist ticket, consisting of U.S. Senator Henry Scoop Jackson from Washington State, a hawkish conservative Democrat, and former Governor Tom McCall of Oregon, an environmentally-minded liberal Republican. They get up to 20% of the vote in the Pacific Northwest, but don't crack double digits anywhere else. Jackson and McCall's political careers are DOA after that, and their ticket is remembered as a funny little historical footnote, unable to stop Lancaster's crushing landslide. Would ya look at that? In our timeline, same as this one, the 1960s and 70s were marked by 2 huge landslide elections, one for each party, under very similar circumstances. The swaggering, boozing incumbent president, who was a corrupt scumbag as a person, but fundamentally a good president, ran against an idealistic candidate from the fringes of the opposite party, who was successfully tarred as a radical and got utterly crushed. Today, we see one of these candidates as having been ultimately vindicated. Goldwater in 64, who arguably founded the modern conservative movement. Ronald Reagan's big break into national politics before he ran for governor of California was delivering a powerful speech in support of Goldwater at the 1964 RNC. When Reagan won in 1980, conservative columnist George Will quipped that Goldwater really won in 64, it just took 16 years to count the votes. But here, it's McGovern who was vindicated. It only took 8 years to count the votes. McGovern in 72 and Lancaster in 80 even had the same running mate. It must have felt awful to be a Democrat in 1976 in this timeline. The last Republican president had been saddled with the worst scandal in the history of the presidency. The economy was going to shit, and we still lost? Well, patience is a virtue. The Lancaster landslide is upon us. Foreign policy dominated American elections in the 70s, but in the 80s, America turns inward. U.S. military bases in Europe are turned over to European powers. The U.S. keeps contributing to NATO, but Lancaster demands European countries pay up for their own defense. French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing calls together a meeting of European leaders on French territory far from Europe, on the French Polynesian island of Moorea. And from the semi-secret Moorea summit emerges the European Economic and Military Community, a supranational semi-state with open borders, a common currency, which will be phased in over the course of a decade, and, most importantly, a unified military, the Eurocorps. The CMEE, which stands for Communauté Militaire et Économique Européenne, is a United States of Europe in all but name. Britain decides not to join, and the CMEE is seen as unpopular but necessary in all its member states except France. The French are sticklers about their sovereignty, but not when they're clearly in charge, and with D'Estaing as the first chair of the CMEE, now they are. D'Estaing's popularity skyrockets, and he's re-elected in 1981 against longtime socialist leader François Mitterrand. At the same time, Burt Lancaster declares a freeze on building new nuclear weapons and announces that the US will never carry out a nuclear first strike. With foreign policy out of his mind, Lancaster embarks on his social democratic program for America. The economy is beginning to stabilize, with both unemployment and inflation going down at last, although, just like how in our timeline, Carter's economic policy fixed stagflation but it took years to work and Reagan reaped the rewards, it was Ford's economic policy, appointing Paul Volcker to the Federal Reserve and passing landmark deregulations of the transportation industry, that really caused the economic recovery of the early 80s. But either way, Lancaster begins announcing that it's morning in America, and successfully manages to convince the public that his reductions in military spending are what caused the economic recovery, which is like 30% true, 40% if we're being generous. In the 1982 legislative session, President Lancaster and House Speaker Tip O'Neill propose AmeriCare, a national health insurance program modeled partially on Britain's NHS, which would end up being the most generous universal healthcare program in the world. Negotiations drag on for the whole year, and it seems doomed several times, or at least destined to be scaled down, but finally AmeriCare passes in spring 1983 by reconciliation. Democrats hold strong House and Senate majorities, even after they lost a few in the 1982 midterms, but many Democrats vote against AmeriCare, and it ultimately relies on support from the dying breed of liberal Northeast Republicans to pass. When the plan was first proposed, AmeriCare drew support from 70% of Americans, but by the time it passes Congress and gets Lancaster's signature, the year of acrimony and attacks from the insurance industry have substantially driven down support, and rallies and marches take place across America against single-payer healthcare. In France, they're marching too, for the opposite reason. A general strike paralyzes the country against President Giscard d'Estaing's plans to dismantle some of the country's famously high taxes and generous worker benefits in order to stimulate the economy and keep paying for their national defense now that America's out of the picture. The railroad and utility workers, high-paid, high-skilled public sector employees, lead the strikes, but nearly every sector participates. France's nuclear reactors are scrammed and the lights go out. D'Estaing doesn't back down. He gives them 2 days to get back to work, or they're all fired. The strike doesn't end, and they're all fired. The French economy isn't doing great in the first place, and now thousands of new jobs have opened up. Given that the leaders of the strike are the railroad employees, who make above-average wages for jobs that have become a lot more comfortable with technology since the benefits were designed for them, public sympathy is against them. In the future, this will be seen as the last great French protest. French leftists and increasingly French right-wing populists will look back with nostalgia on the days when France was synonymous with massive, unruly strikes. But those days ended in the summer of 83, when Valéry Giscard d'Estaing stared down the unions and didn't blink. Republicans line up to challenge Lancaster in 1984. AmeriCare's approval ratings are still underwater by the end of 1983, and there's hay to be made from the massive tax hikes required to fund it. Former National Security Advisor George H.W. Bush, the 1980 vice presidential nominee, announces his bid for president with the promise, "Read my lips, no new taxes." His main primary challenger is the young, charismatic Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon, whose agenda is based on moderation and vague good vibes. Packwood is willing to endorse some of Lancaster's labor and tariff agenda, if not AmeriCare, and refers to his platform as new ideas. At a Republican primary debate, Bush assails Packwood with one of the most iconic political quips in American history. "When I hear your new ideas," he says, "I'm reminded of that old cop show Burke's Law. What does it do? That's the beauty of it. It doesn't do anything." Bush wins the primaries, but his lead against Lancaster is disappearing. As 1984 dawns, AmeriCare surpasses 50% then 60% approval ratings. Blue-collar America is back. Factories that closed in the 70s or even the 60s are reopening. Lancaster does a joint ad with the AFL-CIO in which he proclaims it's morning in America. And on the campaign trail, he attacks Bush as the favored candidate of economists, those dreaded economists who said his tariffs would impoverish America, not realizing that America is big enough to sustain an awfully substantial internal economy without much trade at all. Lancaster and Shriver get a further boost from an October surprise. Ever since he got into office, Vice President Shriver has been attending a series of meetings in Alaska with Soviet leaders Leonid Brezhnev, then when Brezhnev dies in 1982, Yuri Andropov, then when Andropov dies in 84, Nikolai Ryzhkov. Right before the 1984 election in the US, Shriver and Ryzhkov reach an agreement on arms reduction talks. If there can be said to be a clear moment when the Cold War ended, it was with the signing of the Girdwood Agreement in October 1984, which committed the US and USSR to scale down their nuclear arsenals over a 25-year timeline. Bush wants to make history with his vice presidential nominee, so he picks Shirley Temple. Is the timeline beginning to jump the shark yet? No, that'll happen. But this is actually much more realistic than Burt Lancaster being president. Shirley Temple, yes, that Shirley Temple, grew up. Shocker, I know. What did she do once she grew up? Somewhat more surprisingly, the answer is not snort coke and sell ghostwritten memoirs. She was extremely smart, politically an arch-conservative Cold War hawk, and wowed Henry Kissinger himself with her detailed knowledge of foreign policy. She didn't need a post-showbiz career, but she became a diplomat because she really was the best person for the job. Under Gerald Ford, she held a bunch of powerful diplomatic positions, the first woman to serve in each of them. According to a popular myth, probably apocryphal but illustrative, foreign leaders would regularly ask her if she was that Shirley Temple, and she'd say no, funny coincidence, she was born right around the same time, but nope. And then the foreign leaders would say, well, of course, that makes sense. What are the odds that fluffy-haired girl would grow up to be one of America's top diplomats, clearly chosen out of merit? In our timeline, Temple was seriously considered for the 1976 Republican vice presidential nomination and hoped to get a juicy cabinet position in Reagan's White House. The only reason she didn't, according to DC gossip at the time, was because she was too close an ally of George H.W. Bush, who was vice president, sure, but still had bad blood with Reagan because he'd been Reagan's main rival for the 1980 presidential nomination. If Bush had run for president on his own earlier in the 80s, and Reagan wasn't part of the picture, especially in a situation where he's the underdog and wanted to attract media attention to his campaign, I honest to God believe that his most likely running mate would have been Shirley Temple. Either way, in this timeline, the gambit doesn't work. This is the 1984 Electoral College map. Not quite as satisfying a sweep as Reagan's 49-state landslide in our timeline, but that's what you get if you reverse the national popular vote margin. Lancaster soldiers on. In 1986, the US passes the world's most generous paid family leave law. The Challenger disaster leads Lancaster to cut funding to NASA and end the space shuttle program, dismissing space as a dangerous, expensive distraction. Lancaster also ramps up immigration enforcement, mobilizing the military to kick out millions of Mexican immigrants, thousands of whom are citizens. Oops. This move is widely popular, praised by unions and by Cesar Chavez, who has been one of Lancaster's top advisors since way back in 1970, when he was credited with marshaling the Hispanic vote in California for Lancaster. Chavez is often seen as the architect of Lancaster's immigration sweeps. The main opposition comes from Republicans, who credit the sweeps with an increase in food prices, since now American farms have to employ citizens, who are bound by minimum wage laws. To this day, Lancaster's immigration sweeps are generally seen as a humanitarian act, saving Mexican farm workers from a state of quasi-slavery on American farms, although by the 2020s, the historical narrative is beginning to change. Also in 1986, AIDS is beginning to scare people. Lancaster has been monitoring the situation since the very beginning, giving occasional press conferences about it since 1983. Last year, he attended the funeral of his friend Rock Hudson, the first major celebrity to die of AIDS, and gave a speech. Though Lancaster is widely supported by the gay community behind the scenes, this is too unpopular at the time for him to ever make it a major theme of his presidency. Shirley Temple regularly attacked Lancaster's friendliness with the gays during the 84 election, although this largely backfired, with the general response from non-Lancaster Democrats and the public being, "Stop telling horrible lies about Lancaster. He's a good man and doesn't like homosexuals any more than you do." In 1986, Lancaster passes a national ban on gay bathhouses and public sex to attempt to control the AIDS epidemic, which sails through both houses of Congress almost unanimously, but burns the bridge of trust Lancaster had with the queer community. Leading gay rights activists support the ban and were consulted on its wording so that it wouldn't be explicitly targeting gay men, but rank-and-file gay people generally oppose it. Next, Lancaster passes a bill funding research into a cure for AIDS. The tide begins to turn on the epidemic, before most Americans realize there's an epidemic at all. The next year, Iran's back in the headlines. The public is rebelling once again, and this time they're successful. Protesters surround Shahbanu Farah Pahlavi's palace for days. Farah refuses to let the military fire on the protesters, and after a week-long standoff, the mob breaks into the palace. Farah is dragged out and beaten to death in the crowd. Iran becomes a secular communist republic under the rule of General Secretary Massoud Rajavi, socially liberal but certainly not democratic, closely allied with the USSR and, for pragmatic reasons opposed by most of the population, Israel. Oil prices suffer a brief global shock, but the oil crisis doesn't reach the levels of 1973, especially in the US, where Lancaster has been spending most of his presidency gradually scaling up biofuel production, with the expectation that the Middle East was fragile and America couldn't count on their oil. 1987 is the first year where America's ethanol sales overtake gasoline sales. A not-so-secret second motive for Lancaster's pivot to ethanol is that American cars need to be redesigned to accommodate a mostly ethanol-based fuel mixture. You can't just pump ethanol into any old car. A big plank in Lancaster's platform has always been to protect the American auto industry from the influx of Japanese cars. And while Japanese cars are tariffed to high heaven by 1987, they're still objectively better than whatever Ford and GM are cranking out, so having a Japanese car becomes a classy status symbol. Well, it won't if they can't run on America's fuel, says Lancaster, announcing that only 10 American car companies, forbidden by law from consolidating, are allowed to use the patented new engine that all American cars are required to run on, formulated to only work on a specific blend of ethanol. It becomes known as the Wallace blend after Henry Wallace III, the son of FDR's Vice President Henry Wallace Jr. Like his father and grandfather, Henry Wallace III is an agricultural scientist who makes the jump into politics, serving as head scientist for Lancaster's ethanol program from 1981 to 86, then getting elected governor of Iowa that year. Over time, Wally becomes a nickname for fuel in general. In 2003, the country's largest chain of filling stations, ISFC, for Iowa State Fuels Cooperative, rebrands as Wally World. Speaking of Japan, by the 80s, the information age is upon us, and Japan is in the pole position. As America's trade with the outside world declines, Tokyo is beginning to replace New York as the world's main financial center, and the finance industry provides a healthy incentive to develop bigger and better computing and communication technology. Meanwhile, Europe is building up their military spending to defend against the Soviets, which is also leading to interesting technological breakthroughs. The government of Taiwan is like, did you know that you can just decide to become the world leader in an emerging industry? And inks deals with Japanese tech companies to make computer chips in Taiwan. Early computer development in the 80s was going on in Japan and the US in roughly equal amounts, but as the decade goes on, the US distinctly falls behind. American companies like Intel and Texas Instruments have their own semiconductor fabs in the US, but retaliatory tariffs prevent American chips from being exported. Taiwan takes the lead. Before long, American chips are a joke. The 1988 election approaches. The global communist bloc is weakened but still united. Some Cold War hawks frame Lancaster's doctrine of peaceful coexistence as a surrender, but the public credits Lancaster with ending the Cold War. The American economy stumbled a couple times in Lancaster's second term, but the factories are humming again. Money is flowing into the Rust Belt, even as it flows out of America's major cities. Americare is popular, and the mood is still generally optimistic. Urban crime, though, is reaching unprecedented levels, which is the main issue the Democrats are playing defense on. With Lancaster term limited, Vice President Shriver is the presumptive Democratic nominee, fending off a brief and unsuccessful primary challenge on his left from Jesse Jackson. The Republicans nominate Paul Laxalt, a conservative senator and former governor from Nevada, who brings on John Chafee, an environmentally focused centrist senator from Rhode Island who voted for Americare, as his running mate. Laxalt's sunny but detail-poor campaign initially leads in the polls. When I was putting this scenario together, I thought, okay, 1988 election, who's going to be the equivalent of Dan Quayle? Who is Shriver going to pick as his vice presidential nominee? Who's a Democratic politician in the 80s who would have been a viable candidate for vice president and was young, good-looking, mostly remembered today for being gaffe-prone and kind of an idiot, and who would allow his opponent on the debate stage to say, Senator, I knew Jack Kennedy, and you're no Jack Kennedy. And then I realized, oh, this is one of the few cross-party comparisons that has one clear correct answer. Joe Biden. Laxalt makes his campaign all about urban crime. He seriously campaigns for the black vote, promising harsh sentences and strict gun control. Laxalt also thinks he has the Hispanic vote on lock because of Lancaster's immigration sweeps, as well as the fact that he comes from Nevada, a heavily Hispanic state, and being of Basque descent, he's technically sort of Hispanic himself. No, I think Basque people are their own thing. I've pissed off both my Basque viewers now, and I'm sorry. I really am. If you're Basque, leave a comment in Euskara letting me know you're here. The Basque are so cool. Anyway, it turns out that the immigration sweeps are pretty popular among Hispanics who are US citizens, you know, the ones who can vote. As for the crime issue, Laxalt makes a fair number of gaffes talking to black community leaders, and Shriver's campaign ads attack him as out of touch at best and overtly racist at worst, highlighting a sob story of a wrongfully incarcerated black woman in Las Vegas who was convicted under crime laws Laxalt passed way back when he was governor. Shriver promises to tackle the root causes of crime. By election day, the main impression the American public has of Laxalt is as something of a stern Wild West sheriff. A smooth-talking man from way out in the desert who doesn't like the wrong sort of people coming into his town. Sergeant Shriver wins in the Democrats' third consecutive landslide. Right then, young, healthy gay men begin suddenly dying all across America, and
Not only gay men, young bohemians of all stripes. By the end of 1988, hundreds are mysteriously dead of the same rare type of heart attack. Is there another, weirder variant of AIDS going around? Who ever heard of a heart attack being contagious? Well, AIDS was a weird new kind of virus. What's happening now? As soon as Shriver gets into office, he convenes a task force on this new apparent epidemic, which is treated as AIDS-related, even though only a handful of the people who died test positive for HIV. And weirder still, it's limited to America. There are no reports from anywhere else of strange deaths with these symptoms. Within weeks, the cause is identified. Armorixin, a vaccine touted as a miracle cure for AIDS, discovered by Canyon Labs, a small research institute in Arizona, specifically started by a consortium of gay doctors to cure AIDS, and funded almost entirely by Lancaster's 1986 bill. Studies were inconclusive on whether armorixin worked, but it didn't seem to have any side effects at the time. While it was still under consideration for federal approval at the beginning of 1989, millions had already taken it. Lancaster's loosening of the stigma around AIDS made the public desperate for a cure. Some state governors, even Republican ones like California's George Dukmejian, gave tentative approval to armorixin and began funding vaccine drives to get it out to the most vulnerable populations. Now it's proven that, over a matter of months, armorixin slowly alters the viscosity of the patient's blood, eventually causing a heart attack. Crash programs are embarked on, but not a lot of people can be saved. In just the year of 1989, more Americans die of armorixin than the total who died in Vietnam. There will be conspiracy theories in the future about why so many politicians were so enthusiastic to get armorixin into people's arms before we were certain it was safe. Most of the founders of Canyon Labs committed suicide after armorixin failed, which can be taken as evidence for one conclusion or the other. In fact, by the 2020s, a strong majority of Americans, when polled, say that armorixin was a conspiracy to kill off gay people. But it really doesn't seem to be. Vaccine skepticism is high on the American left and remains so for decades. By the dawn of the 90s, American cities fucking suck. Industrial towns are thriving, as are Midwestern cities getting a windfall from the ethanol boom. In 1990, the top three most moved to cities are Omaha, Des Moines, and Detroit. The top three most moved out of are New York, Boston, and San Francisco. The white-collar industries that used to anchor those cities are moving to Europe and Japan, and with their loss comes utter ruin. Between 1970 and 2000, two-thirds of the New York subway is abandoned. A joke goes around that in President Shriver's economy, your options for a good-paying job are the three I's: industrial, international, or illegal. That is, either work in a factory, emigrate, or turn to a life of crime. For the first time in its history, the United States begins to have a real problem with brain drain. These days, it seems like every other hot new company listing on the Tokyo Stock Exchange or the CME's new stock exchange in Rotterdam is founded by an Ivy League-educated American who decided their prospects were better abroad. Abandoned factories were once a symbol of America's decline, but the tariffs brought the factories back. Now it's abandoned skyscrapers, which dot the skylines of most major coastal cities. In general, the 90s begin with a strong feeling of malaise among the American public, with the disaster of armorixin heralding an era of ever greater forces beyond one nation's control. President Shriver announces a bold new gambit, which he claims will revive urban America: reparations for slavery. Under a pilot program, 10,000 black families in each of New York, Philly, Baltimore, DC, Atlanta, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, LA, and Houston will receive a no-strings-attached check for $1,000 a month. Meanwhile, on trade, Shriver continues what Lancaster started. He spends most of his presidency negotiating a bill to hike tariffs specifically on Canada, Japan, and the CMEE, which comes to be known as the Shriver-Perot Tariff Act, for its main co-sponsor in the Senate, Republican Senator from Texas, Ross Perot. See, even Republicans are beginning to get on the tariff bandwagon, since the notion that Lancaster's tariffs saved the American economy in the 80s has become nearly universal with the public. The economy begins to teeter as the 1990s dawn, and by 91, America is in recession, but that gets put down to the sudden death of thousands of young people from armorixin and the failure of a handful of big companies that America didn't really need anyway. Still, the public can't just shrug off a recession. The once wildly popular Shriver is down in the polls as he runs for re-election in 1992. Emerging from a crowded Republican primary is a previously unknown upstart, John McKernan, the governor of Maine. He's hot, he's young, he's viciously smart, and resolutely moderate. His ads declare that he's not your father's Republican and calls for, quote, an end to free trade as you know it. Just like President Shriver, he supports the Shriver-Perot Tariff Act. In fact, his wife is one of the bill's strongest supporters, and that matters because she's a politician too. McKernan's wife, Olympia Snow, serves in the House of Representatives for Maine's 2nd District, which is interesting. America hasn't had a first power couple like this since FDR and Eleanor, and certainly has never had a first lady serving in elected office herself. In the future, the headlines declare, this will be the norm. But first, McKernan will have to win, and at the beginning of 1992, he's 2nd in the polls, not behind Shriver, who's down in 3rd, but behind Steve Forbes, publisher of Forbes, who is running an idiosyncratic pro-business, pro-free trade campaign as an independent. His overall lead is short-lived, but Forbes polls well enough that once the race is down to him, Shriver, and McKernan, he's invited to appear in presidential debates. At the debates, Forbes famously questions whether new technology will make the Constitution obsolete, and declares that Shriver-Perot will create a giant sucking sound of white-collar jobs leaving the U.S. Forbes' running mate, the former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Missouri, Clarence Thomas, is less inspiring. At the vice presidential debates, he barely says anything. Thomas is dogged by sexual harassment allegations throughout his campaign, all while Forbes refuses to drop him from the ticket. McKernan breaks all the rules of vice presidential selection with his choice of running mate, U.S. Senator John Sununu, who was just elected to the Senate from New Hampshire in 1990 after serving as governor there for 8 years. You're not supposed to pick a running mate who is too much like you, but Sununu is young like McKernan, white like McKernan, moderate like McKernan, and from a demographically identical neighboring state. It's a bold strategy, but it does in fact pay off. McKernan defeats Shriver in a landslide. In this timeline, it's the first time an incumbent president running for re-election has been defeated since, get this, Herbert Hoover. Forbes doesn't win any states, but he does best in the suburbs of big cities. In Arizona, he pushes Shriver down to 3rd place, the first time in modern times an incumbent president has ever finished 3rd in a state, while in Shriver's native Maryland, it's McKernan who gets 3rd place. Forbes finishes 3rd in all other states. After the election, the Shriver-Perot Tariff Act finally clears Congress and gets President Shriver's signature during his lame duck period, with McKernan there in the Oval Office praising the bill as well. Once he's sworn in, McKernan promises a huge tax cut to the American public, but it's not clear how it'll be funded. Olympia Snow takes the lead on marshaling the tax bill through Congress, but it runs into opposition both inside and outside the GOP, and after a year of negotiations, it's quietly buried. The 1993 budget dismantles what's left of Amtrak. With cities hollowing out, public transit is simply becoming too expensive to justify. Shriver's reparations plan is also seen as a failure and also quietly dismantled in McKernan's first term. Studies seem to show that the money doesn't have any impact on crime or education outcomes, and with urban crime still at record levels, even most black people in America tell pollsters that they're worried about that money going to line the pockets of gangs. The Democrats call this a racist myth, but an investigation from McKernan's DOJ proves that this is partially true, although not gangs in the Bloods and Crips sense. Rather, rings of city-level politicians have formed in city halls to control the distribution of the reparations money, sometimes giving the money out as acts of patronage or to pay off would-be challengers from running for office, often white city councilmen or mayors, who seek to use reparations money as a way to control and retain the black vote. Two notable big city mayors, one white and one black, are ensnared in this investigation: Richard Daley Jr. of Chicago and Marion Barry of DC. Dude's name was Marion Barry. It's like how the real-life 1890s governor of Texas, Jim Hogg, named his daughter Ima Hogg. A bipartisan crime crackdown bill, partially designed by the now-out-of-office former Democratic Vice President Joe Biden, passes Congress. The brief era of reparations will be studied in more detail by historians later on, and a gradual consensus will start to form that they were more successful than not, but no experiment like that has yet been tried again on a federal level. The economy is still just okay, and Democrats notch huge gains in the 1994 midterms. Notably, Sergeant Shriver's son Bobby is elected governor of California. The powerful hardline House Democratic leader, John Conyers, promotes a list of policies he calls the Contract for Progress, which is initially popular, but Conyers' uncompromising attitude quickly makes his approval ratings tank once he's House Speaker. Republicans score one interesting win in the midterms, though. Congresswoman and First Lady Olympia Snow moves up to Maine's Class 1 Senate seat, becoming arguably the most powerful freshman senator ever. How is the global stage? The USSR still exists, not a democracy, but far more free and open than it was before the late 80s. Nikolai Ryzhkov is the general secretary all the way into the 2010s and remains a pretty popular figure. Communist symbols are still officially displayed everywhere, but in practice they've largely adopted capitalism. Living standards in the USSR approach Western ones. Arts and culture thrive. East Germany briefly becomes a pariah state to both the Eastern and Western blocs, under the hardline control of Erich Honecker. Until he dies in 1994, the Berlin Wall falls, and Germany is reunified. China saw a successful democratic revolution in 1989, but they only ever have one free and fair election in 1991, before President Bao Tong takes on emergency powers to quell protests against him and never ends the state of emergency. China remains desperately poor, with among the highest rates of malnutrition and illiteracy in the world, still building new steam trains all the way into the 2020s. Their main friend on the global stage is Israel, the Hermit Kingdom, which is now led by Moshe Shamir's granddaughter Tzipora, and still insists that they are the world's only true socialist state. The 90s are a decade of innovation, but for the first time since arguably the 19th century, most of that innovation isn't happening in the US. The tech and finance sectors aren't coming back after the early 90s recession. In 1994, Atari stunned the world with the release of the Atari Ocelot, the most advanced gaming console anyone's ever seen. It has something most ordinary people didn't even know existed at this point, a touchscreen. In fact, it only has a few buttons. Everything you can do on it, you can do through the multi-touch touchscreen. As a video game console goes, it's huge and heavy, but it's more than a video game console. It's a whole computer with word processing software, email, a built-in encyclopedia, the ability to pair it with nearby Atari Ocelots, and it's deliberately easy to hack it to pair it with other devices. The Atari Ocelot is the brainchild of Steve Jobs, who'd been a co-founder of the now-defunct American computer company Apple back in the 70s, got pushed out of Apple in 1985, founded another computer company of his own called Next, which was acquired by Atari in 1987. Hounded by tariffs and taxes on its chips, Atari, which, despite its Japanese name, had always been an American company, relocated its main headquarters to Japan in 1989. Steve Jobs had already been working at their Tokyo offices since he joined Atari. There, he introduced American management practices that were copied by other Japanese tech companies, making Jobs into a basically messianic figure at the dawn of the 90s in Japan. Nerds in America, building out the proto-internet, begin accessing their Usenet newsgroups through their Ocelots, although buying an Atari Ocelot in the US costs several $1,000s, compared to the equivalent of a few hundred in Japan since it's a Japanese-designed gadget made in Taiwan. European nerds do something much more interesting. They realize they can use an ocelot to access the Minitel. The Minitel is the European Economic and Military Community's own electronic communication network. Invented in France in the 70s and expanded across the CMEE in the 80s, the Minitel is a system where you can plug a TV into a phone line and access news, games, instant messaging, online shopping, and phone books. For the record, this really existed, albeit just in France. France literally invented the internet in the 1970s. As Europe became more connected, the CMEE commissioned an Office of Cybernetics, which hired British computer scientist Tim Berners-Lee when the UK joined the CMEE in 1988 under Prime Minister Michael Foot. Berners-Lee invented the necessary protocols, HTML, HTTP, URLs, that allowed the Minitel to truly go global. By the early 90s, half of Europe uses the Minitel daily. In 1995, Japan officially joins the Minitel after nerds have been finding ways to access the Minitel in Japan for years, and the next year, the USSR is connected to the Minitel. So, where's America's Minitel? A few local entrepreneurs tried to start Minitel connections in their areas across the US in the early 90s, but the Supreme Court rules in 1993 in Andreessen v. California that a law Lancaster passed in his first term restricting foreign telecommunications companies from operating in the US can be used to ban the Minitel. The McKernan administration announces the launch of an all-American alternative to the Minitel, which they called the Internet, in 1995. It's designed by the same people who put together an experimental interactive TV channel called Cube in the late 70s. Nobody uses the internet, and it sucks. As it becomes clearer and clearer that America's protectionism is hurting them in the digital age, in 1998, President McKernan summons a bipartisan coalition in Congress to pass a law allowing America to join the Minitel. The 1996 election saw an old Democratic stalwart come back out of the woodwork to run for president a second time, George McGovern. Well, worked for his running mate, right? And Lancaster showed that McGovern's 1972 campaign was ultimately justified by history, right? McGovern brings on Senator and former NBA star Bill Bradley as his running mate, but things are going well in America. Too well for Americans to want to change. McKernan and Sununu defeat McGovern in, well, not as big a landslide as McGovern's previous loss, but still not a small margin. Steve Forbes runs again, having now started a party of his own, the Freedom Party, and bringing on a running mate who's supposed to be less controversial, but really is every bit as weird, the aging heterodox economist Milton Friedman. Forbes gets half the vote he got in 92. While both major parties in the US are now largely pro-tariffs, pro-organized labor, anti-immigration, and pro-protectionism throughout the 90s, an undercurrent of discontent exists among the creative underground, the sort of people who publish zines and have illegal Minitel uplinks. Japan overtook the US as the world's biggest economy in 1998, and neither McKernan nor the Democrats seem to care, with Vice President Sununu dismissing the news saying, "Well, our economy is more compassionate." In response, the slogan, "Compassion for me, not for you," appears in graffiti across the US. Popular alternative magazines like Tariff Busters highlight the plight of the billions of impoverished people in the developing world and how much their lives could be improved if developed countries were to outsource their factories to developing countries, or let them immigrate to America. But no, our political system would never, ever let those precious American union jobs be threatened. The 1999 Teamsters Conference in Seattle is marred by massive protests against the union's purported stranglehold over American trade policy. Whole Earth Catalog founder Stuart Brand announces a pro-free trade, pro-globalization campaign for the presidency in 2000 under the Green Party banner, similar in some respects to Forbes' campaigns, but more left-libertarian than right-libertarian, and he gains support from 90s alt-culture figures and Seattle protesters. 90s radicals also begin to enviously look towards Canada, where Prime Minister Kim Campbell ended a long period of liberal rule in 1995 with a promise to deviate from the global protectionist consensus. Under what becomes known as the Canadian Experiment, Canada slowly, carefully dismantles the tariff regime that Pierre Trudeau and Joe Clark put together over the course of their long premierships. Barriers to immigration are removed, trade deals are signed with rich countries like Japan and poor ones like China. Long-haul shipping is revolutionized with so-called Canadian containers. Time will tell what will happen to the Canadian experiment. The US economy is still generally pretty good. Japan may be richer now, but again, America is big enough that a hermetically sealed economy can still be pretty self-sustaining and generate a high standard of living for most people. McKernan is still quite popular going into the 2000 election, and it's expected that Sununu will pick up his legacy. Sununu fends off the more free market-minded Congressman Jack Kemp in the primaries and becomes the Republican nominee, facing off against Democrat Bobby Shriver, son of Sargent. Bobby Shriver co-owned the Baltimore Orioles in the late 80s. See how well this fits together? What other political Nepo baby owned an MLB team before he got into politics? In this timeline, Bobby Shriver was considered a viable candidate for either governor of Maryland, his dad's home state, or California, where he splits his time. Bobby Shriver decided to run in California in the blue wave year of 1994, in which he defeated incumbent Governor Pete Wilson to become California's first Democratic governor since Burt Lancaster. Shriver isn't quite as charismatic or inspiring as his dad, but he's got the famous name. As for the vice presidential selections for the 2000 election, Sununu picks Arlen Specter, a senator from Pennsylvania, an unapologetic moderate, and the first Jew on a national ticket. On the Democratic side, Shriver is seen as a bit of a political novice, despite his six successful enough years as governor of the most populous state, and he tasks his vice presidential selection to Hamilton Jordan. Hamilton Jordan. Now that's a name I haven't heard in a long, long time, say a lot of voters, although politicians are a bit more aware that he's still around. Way back in the 70s, when Jordan was just in his 20s, fresh out of college and fresher out of Vietnam, he was the campaign manager for Jimmy Carter's 1970 run for governor of Georgia, then served as Carter's chief of staff when he was governor. In 1976, Jordan was the manager for Carter's presidential campaign. Expected to be named White House Chief of Staff if Carter was elected, Jordan's political rise was somewhat blunted by the fact that Carter lost, but by 1978, enough voters were dissatisfied with the Ford administration that that stain had been largely erased. That year, Jordan moved back to his childhood home state of North Carolina and ran for Senate, defeating one-term Republican incumbent, the notorious racist Jesse Helms. Jordan was re-elected in 1984, alongside Lancaster winning North Carolina, then declined to run for a third term in 1990. Throughout the 90s, Jordan stuck to the shadows in DC, advising Democratic politicians through his consulting outfit. Jordan vets a bunch of up-and-coming Democrats to be Shriver's running mate, and then announces that he has picked himself. The 2000 Democratic vice presidential nominee isn't going to be any of those guys. It's going to be Hamilton Jordan, says Hamilton Jordan. Okay, says America. The 2000 election is the closest in history, both in the popular and electoral vote, and it comes down to a deadlock in Ohio, eventually settled by the liberal majority Supreme Court in favor of Shriver. The popularity of Stuart Brand's pro-globalization campaign on the Minitel didn't translate into a great showing at the polls, but his performance in Ohio ended up being several times the size of the margin between Shriver and Sununu. Shriver aspires to be the education president, clumsily summed up on the debate stage with a memorable gaffe. Rarely is the question asked, is our children learning? He passes a modest education reform act as soon as he gets into power, but history has other plans for him. Tune in next week for the rest of the story, or if you're watching this on YouTube, join the Tours Cabinet Patreon and watch the rest of the story right now.
Take the blame.